It's really great to be introducing Ellen McGrath Smith, who was the person who was the teacher in the first poetry workshop I ever took. And because she was tender and kind to me when I knew nothing, I kept going. And then I eventually wandered in and found Michael Worster and Jan Beatty and all sorts of other folks, and been really lucky, but it was really helpful. And I really thank Ellen. God bless. Ellen McGrath Smith teaches at the University of Pittsburgh and in the Carlo University Mad Women in the Attic program. Her poems have appeared or are forthcoming in a lot of places, including Kestrel, Oranges and Sardines, Diner, 5 a.m., Oxford Magazine, the Prose Poem, and a whole bunch of other places. Her critical work has been published in Sagtrieb, the Denver Quarterly, American Book Review, and other journals, and her poetry has been recognized with an Academy of American Poets Award, a Rainmaker Award from Zone 3 Magazine, and more recently, a 2007 Individual Art Grant from the Pennsylvania Council of the Arts. And she is just a wonderful person. Yay! Ellen Smith!
Okay, I'm gonna get really close. Wow. Wow. Three Rivers Review. Joan, thank you for that great introduction. And I wanna thank Joan and Jimmy for doing this every summer and giving a lot of time and effort to and making it a really inclusive reading series. It's a real gift to Pittsburgh, and they're both really hardworking, extraordinary poets, and for them to give back in that way is very generous. What I'm reading tonight is a mix. You're back. I thought you were in Central America. Okay. All right. I'm reading a mix of poetry and prose, and it's got some collage elements in it, which I'll gloss through. And it's called The Locust, a Foundational Narrative. And what I should say are a couple of things. A couple of things include, I'm really indebted to Deborah Bogan. A lot of this writing came at her writing group that she generously organizes and runs with her husband, Jim. And a lot of the work in the later versions of this, a lot of the workshopping has also come from Deborah. So thank you. I'm really happy to be reading with both Deborah and Rosalie. It's amazing to be sandwiched between such great poets. So, The Locust, a Foundational Narrative. The other thing is that when I'm talking about the locust in here, I'm talking about the locust as a bug, you know. Locust as a tree sometimes, but also locust, the locust pose in yoga. Some of the collage elements talk about what the posture consists of, and I'll gloss through those quickly. This opens with a little Facebook exchange from one of my yoga teachers. She posted on her Facebook page, she said, what would you attempt if you knew you could not fail? And my answer was, and it was an honest answer, I think, pitch in the majors. And so that starts this hybrid piece that I'm going to try to read, and I hope it works okay. I hope it's not too weird. It lay there like a father who had worked a double shift, not dead, but not ready to resume its upright role anytime soon. When the graying locust fell from lightning, I learned that the direction and poles of the earth operated independently of my location. The tree was on a hill behind our house. It was broken by electric teeth, nosed over by a dogged western wind. And even though the center of my drama was that it could have smashed our house, it didn't. It was also a bridge between our yard and the Wallaces, waiting for us to make something new of it. It became a pirate ship we rocked when there were enough of us to rock it. It's accidental entropy, the only ocean I would know until I was 19. It was taken away, the way a few years before the cat had been put to sleep. Generations of sapling and young adult locusts struggled up and down our hill, while next door's yard became a forest, something I understood as having to do with the son's involvement in drugs. You do not know where on earth they go and when they're coming back, but when they're here, the world is machinal. The air is full of consequences. I am running down the hill beside the Maronite church, having given myself ultimatums. Soldiers are after me. Robbers are after me. I'm a saint, and some pagans are after me, ready to make me a martyr. Could I endure being burned at the stake? The flames are just words, and I learned to read with such ease that no one can remember my learning. I am running home to dinner, but it has to be more. And although I'm not the naked girl running from my own napalm skin, we share that puzzling grin below our navels, the grin that more and more makes me wonder, am I really weaker than my brothers? I'm running faster than a person ever ran, and running right into a bullet with my forehead. The impact sends its echoes through my skull, and I stop running near the bottom of the hill. No blood. I look around for enemies, my plastic-soled feet throbbing from repeated slaps on the macadam, and see it on the ground, the bullet near my foot, still singing a thin bass to the collision. It's winged and near transparent, more in shock than I am. When I write it, it can't fly away, this tight-wound reel of programmed flight I interrupted. The wings seem man-made, high-tech, and its body's a transistor. He was a man who couldn't take joy in children. They were tiddlywinks spinning into vaultless skies, unmanned power saws, brakeless cars, and he had many children. There is nothing to Google if I wanted to prove my genetics of baseball. If I click on my mother in person, she'll tell me my father pitched semi-pro ball while he was stationed with the Air Force in Kansas City. She'll tell me he might have gone on to the pros, that it stopped somewhere. He's dead, so I can't ask him to show me the chalk lines, the choices, the place where he dropped the ball. With my own equipment, I fill in. Heavy drinking, bad temper, low tolerance for frustration. Too much for a gangly right arm to overcome. I worked hard not to throw like a girl. I could throw far or near with a measure of precision. My shoulders were loose, which can help with expression, extension, finesse, in the way that a pitch is a sentence or song, with beginning and middle and end, yes, but also with rise, stride, some reticence, then the acceptance of landing for better or worse. The times he played catch with me were so rare they were edged with self-consciousness. My brothers, each in turn, approached baseball and got Dad's attention for a time, which was not necessarily a good thing. Those few occasions when he was in the stands at the Little League games, he yelled at the coaches, the umpires, the kids, with a special sort of yelling reserved for his own kid. He never came to my softball games, though I did pitch. I had a spinner, and I took the act of pitching very seriously. When I was on the mound, there was a force field around me of atoms charged both with my hope and my failure. A good arm. I'd have liked him to tell me I had one. He laughed so hard he cried, telling my mother about the boys' invention. They tied fishing line around the locusts and were flying them like tiny buzzing kites. I saw teardrops in his eyes. If he could have, he would have shaken off his shell and torn down the alley shouting, "Let me try." When I go walking with my mom, we look into so many yards, both of us with a longing we don't have to mention. So many yards know what trees are and how they blend into the overall picture of yards. There are some full of lip-blossomed maples my mother thinks are Japanese. In our house full of boys and men, Books are what I have in common with my mother. Books are lady things. A triple play is a scribble, the seismograph needle connecting itself in tight little harsh little angles. Here are the possible triple play combinations. Shortstop to third base to second to first, or more commonly, third snags and steps on his base before zinging it over to first, who backhands it to second. Triple plays are more likely when bases are loaded and runners start running as soon as it looks like the ball will break through. I imagine a catcher to first base can happen if, on a strikeout, ball's dropped, batter runs, catcher grabs it and tags the guy heading for home, then whales it to first, where the runner to second is just getting going and the runner to first almost foot to the pad. I keep score in a notebook. I decorate with player picks and lists of statistics. Here's my scorecard. There's a pool of grease in the middle of the garage, a cool rising up from the floor. My bike is broken. My sleeves are rolled up. I'm a 12-year-old tough guy, a girl standing there, my hands in my back pockets, trying to think of a way to repair it. My companion, my transistor radio, is tuned into the Pirates game. My emotions are parsed into innings, at bats. I know every catch in the play-by-play voices. I count RBIs, ERAs, home runs, errors. Upstairs, my father's watching the same game on TV. I step outside to spit on an elephant ear. There are tools on the floor, and I think that by spitting, I'll know how to use them. My bike needs fixed, but I won't ask for help. My mother has a book about yoga she looks at. Another book pressing it open to plates as she sits on the living room floor and maneuvers her limbs to match those of the thin blonde-haired girl in the photos. The book teaches her, and she teaches me. We make animal shapes with our bodies. I try it again and again and cry because my body fails to hear the brain's commands. Inert and face down, I try it again and again. Full locust. Join my hands below my pelvis. Push them down like a lever. Still, my lower body doesn't rise, which means I cannot fly. It is a trick my mother has shown me, a way to help me do the locust until my abdominal muscles grow stronger. Clasp hands into a single fist and bury them under my torso to form a kind of lever. This puts the fist right under my pubic bone, which makes me feel ashamed. If you touch the cartilage of my right ear, you can feel the dent where the rusty fence snagged me. We were using it for a backstop in the baseball field we built on the dump. The boys insist that this was all their project, but this dent proves I was there as well, dragging the powdered orange metal through the vines. We made dugouts, too. I had a pack of stolen cigarettes I kept in one. Sometimes I'd step out of the house and go down there for a smoke. It never tasted very good, but added height and maybe balls to my macho solitude. The pack lasted a long time. I hid it underneath the boys' contraband playboys, full of women who looked like another species altogether. It had ripped a chunk out of my ear, the fencing. And later, when I learned of Van Gogh, I thought, I know what you mean. The way he laughed, my father, at my brother's wild invention with the locusts, like he had never seen them before and was thrilled to discover that they were his. Another book my mother shared with me, The Good Earth by Pearl S. Buck. This writer lived in China, and she won a Nobel Prize. This child of ours is a pretty little maid, even now. Tell me, were the pretty slaves beaten also? And she answered indifferently, as though it were nothing to her this way or that. I, beaten or carried to a man's bed, as the whim was, and not to one man's only, but to any that might desire her that night. And the young lords bickered and bartered with each other for this slave or that, and said, then if you tonight, I tomorrow. And when they were all alike wearied of a slave, the men servants bickered and bartered for what the young lords left. And this was before a slave was out of childhood, if she were pretty. This book really messed with my head. Face down and lying on your fist, the king is calling. You must go and please the king. Very young and dying on your fist, tears in your eyes. Where did you learn about the ways the king's commanded? What is all this shuddering about? K is what you put down for a strikeout. One time, some fans draped a banner at the stadium consisting of three Ks. It gave me chills when I first saw it, but all it meant was they were rooting for the pitcher to retire a whole inning's worth of batters. I heard Dutch Ryan up the street tell Mrs. Miller, I wouldn't cross the street to watch those niggers play. I looked up at the picture window of his house the day Roberto died and tried to burn my eyes through the smugly drawn drapes. I went home and traced in pencil my old poster of Clemente, his perfect nose and his arrogant neck, smoothing out the wrinkles in the glossy. My father torn it down and crumpled it, saying I shouldn't have men like that on my bedroom wall. Now here's a quote from a psychologist with an unfortunate name, Karen Horney. I'm pronouncing it that way to get around certain things. But I'm just going to read through that. Okay, so my father torn it down and crumpled it, saying I shouldn't have men like that on my bedroom wall. Let us suppose that God's voice is psychologically equivalent to the Father's, an assumption that is warranted through 1,000 experiences. Thus, at the core of the basic situation would be the fact that the prohibition of feminine experiencing is connected with her feelings for her father, and that this prohibition, projected to the father, pushes her into a masculine role. The complete breakdown would therefore not arise because she loves an enemy of the country, but because she loves at all, and because the repressed femininity has broken through and is accompanied by feelings of guilt. Incidentally, it is very characteristic that this conflict leads not only to emotional depression, but also to failure in her male achievement. In another fantasy, the kings are strewn throughout the stadium, indistinguishable from the queens and princes, thousands of them, paying fans, and the mound you ground against your fist is now a mound of packed ground. Homing, you lift up one leg, pull your arm back, and hurl the white light toward the open leather fist. The catcher is a locust crouching there inside the chain-link foliage of Sunday afternoon, Day of the Lord, American Pie delivery. My mother showed me a variation of half locust. Lift the one extended leg and rest its thigh on the sole of the foot of the other, bent to be a sawhorse or bench. Even now, she's the one who says, you're making it harder than it needs to be. Oh, you're some kind of nympho, he said, thorax raised above me, words of love shed at the doorway with the pieces of our clothing, a blaze of bourbon lighting up the cluttered space between. I asked him if he meant eternal teenager, for if he did, I could admit to it. The grass was always greener, and my hind legs tried to match the height of every greener blade. The difference between a nit and a nymph is greater than the difference between a nymph and an adult. The song of the locust rises up the shafts of the trees surrounding you. The song that is like the concession to hay the grass makes, like the hum in your throat when you know that you love having this in your mouth, though you know that this isn't real power in spite of the tears in his eyes at the end. At which point, the poem wants to turn back to nature and explain, or run away from itself and its subject. Of course, they drill deep holes into the ground. Of course, the hatchlings go in there, and many years go by. No doubt, they are like violins submerged in water. Summer when it's under siege. Thanks.